Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Okay, you are fortunate enough to be back in the House of Mystery. I'm broadcasting from the House of Mystery bunker in Canada, and I've got Michael Hawley in Buffalo.
That is correct, Al.
and he just turned really old, I think, not just last week.
Yes, 58, but rumor has it I have the body of a 57-year-old, though.
Well, that's debatable. Now, we've got a treat. We've got,
yes, we do.
From the UK, we've got a historian and author and, well, he's just loaded with tricks. It's Neil Storey. Thank you for being here, Neil.
Well, thank you. Greetings across the water. And I send a message to everybody, both sides of the big old pond. Just hang in there, folks, with all this COVID issues. Be good to each other. Be kind. Be safe. I hope everything will work out.
You're a historian, and that's interesting. So you kind of know about the pandemic flu of the early 1900s. Did they have the same sort of response then, as far as you know?
This is interesting because they say that disasters, things like floods, often have a 50-year cycle, and pandemics have a 100-year cycle. And believe it or not, Black Death tried to make a little bit of a comeback. We've never truly found a cure for it. And that's only really dealt with by isolation, complete isolation of an area. And it came ashore from a boat in Great Britain. But they managed to cut off the area. A few people did die. But that reared itself on British soil. So when, from 1918, you've got what they called it the Spanish flu epidemic, that spread into the early 20s. Across Europe. And do you know that it killed more people, men, women and children, killed more people than were killed in the First World War? And remember, the First World War, for example, for Great Britain, was between 1914 and 1918. So it's a considerably longer war than many American citizens might realise, for us anyway.
Right.
Did they try to protest too back then, or was it?
It was a very different world back then, and people, they did what they were told because it was the way they were raised. They were raised in a very, you've got to remember, these are men that felt a patriotism enough to go over the top. You mustn't forget that. Patriotism was very important. And it was felt by people from all nations, you know, even people without a monarch. You know, if you look at America, you've got a president. But you've still got soldiers, they're volunteering or drafting. They're going, they're doing their bit. And they're facing some very challenging times. That if you had a breakdown in the discipline, that it would have been a lot worse. There were examples of mutinies, but they were contained. So when it came to the flu epidemic, people could they listened to the warnings. They got them through the channels of notices being put up. We didn't have radio at that time. You have to remember, you had to rely on newspapers, information through your door, and local police. And if you didn't obey that, then you felt this sense that you'd be letting your neighbours down, you're letting your friends down, and you could get into trouble. And it really meant some people respected the police and the military authorities. So, yeah, for the flu epidemic, they were pretty good because they could see why. They understood why you had to stay in, because if you don't stay in, you'll catch it, and it could well kill you. And I think it's a great tragedy that I've heard via the British news this week that America has now lost more people to COVID-19 than died in the Vietnam War. And I think that's a very, very, very sad state, and all of our hearts go out to our friends and our many friends in America and everybody in the States.
Right, and Canada, wherever.
It's terrible. So for my money, the lessons are all there. As a historian, it's there. I don't see it as anything to do with control. Everybody is entitled to their views. And of course, we all respect that. But I think it's quite clear that it's real. It kills. And it's quite an easy way. You don't need to go and even have an injection to get over it. You've just got to stay in and you know, reconnect with some family, enjoy some books, enjoy some TV, cook at home if you can, you know, just make sure and just be good to each other. That's the key.
Well, we don't want Michael cooking.
I hear Mike's a bit of a demon in the kitchen, actually.
Yeah, that's why my wife kicks me out of there. She's an awesome Italian chef. So if I get in there, do the dishes, because I love her food.
Sounds pretty good.
Yeah. Just give him a beer and he's fine. A fine lager.
Yeah, fine lager.
A fine lager.
That's correct.
Now, talking about Jack the Ripper, I was going to say this kind of ties in. So in the late 1800s, what was London like? What was it like to live there, and what was the atmosphere like? Were people working? Was there a lot of crime? What was going on?
Well, in the 1880s, we have to imagine this is the London of Queen Victoria. Now, Her Majesty Queen Victoria had an empire, the Great British Empire, that spread all over the world. It didn't control every country, but they used to say it was the empire upon which the sun never set, because at some point in the day the sun would be shining on some part of the British Empire. But as we all know, sadly, in some parts of the world, in Africa and India, there are people in abject poverty. And when you think of Victorian Britain, you think of all these fine skirts and dresses and the high street pictures that you'll see on engravings and photographs. But that was half the story. You have got an underclass, an underbelly that was locked away. Like a lot of things in Victorian Britain, if they didn't like the look of it. For example, there were public executions until the 1860s, and there were complaints from people like Charles Dickens, the well-known author, that this was a vile public thing to do in public. Execution is wrong in general. And all the British authorities did was they closed the doors on it. They said, right, we will conduct executions behind closed doors in prison. And so they did until the 1960s. So there's a lot of things hidden. There's a lot of things that are ignored. But if you went to the east end of London, London was a very, it's the heart of the British Empire. There is great wealth there, but there is also abject poverty. And the poorest part of London was the East End. This is where, remember, there's no social security checks. You'd have to rely on charity. Men would want to go and work in the nearby docks. If you look on a map of London, this sort of U-shape where you see, maybe if you see the British soap opera EastEnders, the East End is just above that loop that you see on the aerial photograph. And so men would go to the docks, they'd queue up, but if there's no work for you, there's no money for you. So they end up kicking around the streets, scraping by what they could, picking rubbish out of bins off the ground to eat. Some people were so poor they would even have to pawn their own boots to try and get some money. And of course, this is the tragedy of the East End, that women that had ended up there were so poor that sometimes they would sell their bodies to get another drink or get a doss for the night in a doss house.
It's pretty incredible. So why is Jack the Ripper still held on to everyone's attention all of this time after? And why are so many people so into it and so involved that they have, you know, an array of suspects? You guys have your meetings, your magazines, there's books, there's movies, there's series. What keeps this alive?
Well, I think what it did initially in 1888, it exposed this underclass. And of course, we're always interested. I think that's why a lot of people are interested in murders. It's because they're not into the gory side of it. But what they want to do is go beyond the barriers, beyond the tape that you see on a modern crime scene. They want to go beyond that and get involved with the investigation, the story behind it, the circumstances behind it. And because since 1888, this is a mystery. You know, there comes a point where cases have to officially be closed, but more modern audiences will be more familiar with the term cold cases. Cold cases that are 20, 30, 40, 50 years earlier get opened again. And for many people, the Ripper has never been closed. It certainly went into more of a lull, I think, from around about the early 20th century up until maybe, probably just around the time of the Second World War, just after, around about that period, when you get books starting to mention it, books on mysteries, and then you get Ingleby Oddie wrote his Inquest book, which talked about people going on this remarkable tour of the crime scenes. These were not regular tours. These were members of the Crimes Club or barristers or old police officers. They all kind of get together and go on these little walks, because at that time, all of the sites were still there. You could stand on the spot. And then in the 1960s, particularly the 70s, you see more of a renaissance with people like Tom Cullen, who was able to talk to people who were kids at the time. And he wrote this very good Autumn of Terror, which is one that really sort of got us in. I think it captured a brand new lot of imagination. There's Dan Farson, people like Melvin Harris as well, and of course the Stephen Knight, this answer to it that emerged. He didn't devise the whole story. It was a story that came by a somewhat circuitous route that involves the royal family, the Queen's surgeon, the artist Walter Sickert, and embroils it into a Masonic cover-up that even fingers, you know, the Queen's grandson, Prince Albert Victor, the Duke of Clarence and Avondale, as Jack the Ripper. How seductive is that?
When you say it, it sounds great.
And, Neil, one of the authorities is Stuart Evans, 50 years worth. And in 1995, he put out a book that was a rediscovery of the suspect, Francis Tumblebee. And what happened was is that the very next book from an authority on that person that I take seriously is your book, The Dracula Secrets.
Wow.
And the reason for that is just what Stuart Evans did, is he had to stop research after 2 years. And he was hoping people would pick it up and continue. And in your book, you have these letters from Francis Tumblebee himself that when you read those letters, you can start to peer into the mind of that suspect, which I would love you to talk a little bit about that.
Well, I must say that we got kind of up to Tom Cullen and Dan Farson, and I will certainly freely recognise the late, great Richard Whittington Egan and Martin Fido and Paul Begg. And they're the guys from the kind of 80s, and Paul's still going very strong. We've sadly lost Richard and Martin, who I counted as a friend, a fellow academic, and we shared a great love of history. And then beyond our work, there are other authors, and very good authors too. But Stuart has combed, really, Great Britain in the days before the internet. He had a great network of book dealers, antique dealers, collectible shops, and he combed it. This is when it was enormously hard to draw on this material. You had to have a good reputation. You had to sometimes put your money where your mouth is. You needed to know what to look for, and you had to be assiduous in your research at the time. And Stuart Evans was that man. And the books that he produced before people could so easily look on the internet and before newspaper searches, it is a truly remarkable body of research.
Yeah.
And when I came to write my book, I wanted to do a book that sort of looked at an overview of London in the period of Jack the Ripper. It became Jack the Ripper's London. And it was done kind of day by day, and it looks at ghostly stories and crimes and murders, and it pointed out quite a few different aspects. For example, that knife crime, fatalities through knife crime on the streets of London, knife crime murders, very, very rare in the 1880s. For example, I was expecting to find knife crime rife. It wasn't. So anyway, when I was researching this, Stuart Evans shared my publisher. And my editor said, look, this is crazy. You guys don't know each other. You seem to work the same way. You think alike. She knew Stuart very well. She said, look, why don't you two get in touch? Well, we did. And it was a remarkable bond. It was, and I'm sure Stuart wouldn't mind me saying, it was like father and son in the history world. Because he is generous, he is honest. If you're talking a load of rubbish, he'll tell you, and he'll tell you why, and he'll explain it, and he will show you the books, the sources that prove that that's wrong. If it is wrong, or if there's a way that, well, maybe it could be, maybe it couldn't, we look at the evidence without bias. You know, people say he's the Tumblety man. He is, in that he had this letter offered to him amongst a number of letters that were originally sent to George R. Sims. But he's more than that. He's a genuine crime historian. His, if you've got the passion, if you are the sort of person that would go and do that extra mile and miles beyond, then Stuart will like you. And I consider it a great honour to count Stuart and his wife Rosie as friends, good friends that we go and visit when we get the chance. Busy, busy lives, and now we're in isolation. But yeah, what a great man. And having got to know Stuart and really felt that infection, that enthusiasm, hearing what Stuart had to say, and the kind of he wishes it, you know, that he could get back to America to do more research. This is before we really knew you, Mike. We've learnt as time has gone on, you know, to do this job, you've got to have friends in the States, you've got to have some friends in Ireland, because Tumblety is an international Jack the Ripper suspect.
Yeah.
But what happened for me was I've always loved Gothic horror as a genre, true Victorian ghost stories and Dracula. I mean, that was one of the big things for me. When I was a young man, the sort of iconic Bela Lugosi and Christopher Lee terrifying the life out of me because he's in colour. and I thought, I want to know more about the man who created Dracula. And as time went on, people say, oh, we don't know much about him. There's not much known. And I always thought that was rather sad, that Bram Stoker, why don't we know about the man? Oh, well, there's not this, there's not that. And thanks to Stuart's work following up Thomas Henry Hall Caine. Now, Hall Caine was the greatest author of his day. He was the first man to sell 1 million books in the English language. And Hall Caine was a great friend of Bram Stoker. They both idolised Henry Irving, the greatest actor of his day. Bram Stoker was the acting manager at the Lyceum Theatre. Hall Caine came along as a guest. And the night they met, it was either going to be love or hate. Because, you know, it could be a jealousy thing that, but they get on. And they got on enormously well. And it was through that connection. There was a documentary featuring Stuart about the discovery of his letter, where there was mention of this archive on the Isle of Man.
Right.
And I suddenly thought, hang on, Dracula is dedicated to Homi Beg. Now, that's Manx for little man. Hmm. And that was the name given by Thomas Henry Hall Caine, that was her pet name for him. And the dedication in the front of Dracula is to Hall Caine, Homi Beg.
Mm.
And at that time, the letters, which were in the Isle of Man archives, were not released. It was part of the Hall Caine archive. It was roughly 10 years. They'd been released, and then they had sort of 10 years to sort through them, catalogue them, because there's fascinating letters from Rossetti, Dante Gabriel Rossetti, Wilkie Collins. You think of great luminaries of their day, the writers that he corresponded with. There's a lot in there. And I helped go through the last box, where we found two more Tumblety letters.
Wow.
And you can imagine that we thought there might be a handful. We had no idea that when I got there, I was able, after the first day, to ring Stuart and say, you're not going to believe this. I always call Stuart Gov. In the British police force, if you're the senior officer, hello, Gov, I've got something to report. It's on all the TV shows. You know the song. I said, Gov,
right.
You're not going to believe this. This is the greatest concentration of Ripper letters from a contemporary Jack the Ripper suspect that has ever been found.
Yeah.
It was an incredible cache. It really was.
And I'm telling you, when you can tell that Francis Tumblety had to have written those letters himself, because he was writing to, you know, his friend. He would not have had someone else write those letters for him. They would have been a personal letter to you know, Hall Caine himself. So that it's a treasure trove of information. And both my books that I wrote, of course, I've used your book as I cited your book a number of times.
Well, Mike, when I got those letters, you could imagine I was very, very excited. And I did want to have some sort of analysis. We knew that their provenance was beyond any question. They'd been in crates and boxes for years and years and years, properly stored away in a recognized archive. There are gaps, of course, in the collection because of the way they were stored for decades in Hall Caine's own lifetime, you know, and things went missing from his summer house, his writing room. But the provenance is good, but I wanted somebody to look at these from not just a graphology point of view, so the graphologist that looks at handwriting. I wanted a forensic document examiner to apply modern skills, and I paid her, you know, the correct sum of money for her professional. Her name is Ruth Myers, mm-hmm. and she has worked on some of the infamous cases in Great Britain, people like the Ipswich Ripper, and there were two young girls killed in a notorious case in Cambridgeshire as well. She's been involved with these cases. She's a genuine expert witness. And so I sent her some copies of these letters and got her to perform, to do just what she would do, with no indication of who it was written by, but just to look at them. And she confirmed that although the handwriting is very different between some of the letters, they are all by the same man. It is from his disturbed mind, really, that it shows all these different personalities. And I've got to say that I would like to pay tribute to Mike. You see, we can only do so much in Great Britain. And the American newspapers, I can't access everything online. I don't know where to look. I'm no expert on America. And I've got to say that the American torch is very, very much in Mike's hand. And the various historians and Tumblety researchers in America that seem to be pretty darn good at talking to each other. And this is one of the greatest things of Francis Tumblety as a suspect, that because he is so good that people tend to get on with one another when we're researching him.
Right, right. We call ourselves Team Tumblety.
I think it's pretty good. We've all got to work together, but I think that torch is with you, Mike, over there, because you have forged forward, taking those letters to places that I could have only dreamt of when I wrote the book. I was hoping that one of the television companies that I was working with would pick up on the analysis of the handwriting with regard to a letter known as the From Hell letter that was sent to George Lusk, the chairman of the Whitechapel Vigilance Committee, with half a human kidney. Now, when Mike and I had a chat a while back, and I understand, is it in America that somebody's actually picked up on that analysis?
Right, and Stuart Evans knows about her. Michelle Dresbold out of Pittsburgh, she had looked at the From Hell letter, and she matched it up with Tumblety. And then, but of course, when you look at the Ripperology as a whole, as you were kind of alluding to, some people don't take that too seriously, but then again, in certain cases, we can. And and to me, I think that we still have more to go, especially with the cache that you discovered with that. And question, do you think that there are more letters there?
Yes. Not in the archive on the Isle of Man. I'm absolutely convinced, because they are very thorough in the Isle of Man archives, that they cherish what they have. Not just the Tumblety letters, all of the material that they have there, they're very, very good at making things accessible. and it is a pleasure. Wendy Thurkettle, I take my hat off to her and thank her and the Isle of Man Archives for being so generous when they helped me with my research.
Right.
But beyond that, because Hall Caine lived in this big house called Greba Castle, and his residence was he did a lot of his writing in a sort of summer house, which became a bit of a dumping ground. Now, I think in the same way that some places that store lots of records, it gets rather tiresome and a box or two get chucked out without.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Too much discrimination of what is in them. No doubt he would have prized certain letters from Rossetti, his correspondence with to and from Bram Stoker. You know, he treasured his Stoker material. But other things, like the Tumblety, maybe. I think there was some that were thrown away. Now, I think there were people that were pretty canny on the Isle of Man because Hall Caine did not like signing autographs. And one of the greatest content of the Hall Caine archive were lots of these letters. And we thought, wow, these look exciting. And they had to be carefully opened, you know, an archivist there. But it turns out that these were people sending picture postcards of Hall Caine, often with a return envelope saying, please, would you sign this for my autograph collection? And he never signed them. He never returned them. He did not like signing autographs. You can see them there. I should think there must be well over 100 of these unreturned, and probably more. They were just the ones that I saw. And I think people were pretty canny that if you had something from the greatest author or greatest selling author of his day, you wouldn't have heard of him today, most people, but he was enormously popular back in the day. And so letters from the man, a signature from the man, would be a highly collectible thing.
Wow.
And so that's why over these years, these batches of letters have turned up, and they are in private hands. And thanks to the kindness of a number of those people coming forward, modern collectors or people who have inherited old collections of autographs and letters from, you know, great uncles or great granddad, and allowed me to access them, they're rather interesting. They really are. So I think there will be more. All of the Tumblety Hall Kane letters that I am aware of and I published, they are all the ones that are in the Isle of Man archives.
The nice thing about that too, Neil, is that you discovered, which I consider the only photograph of Francis Tumblety, and what's really interesting about that photograph was that there was an earlier photograph, supposed photograph of Francis Tumblety, that was actually on Tumblety's 1871 autobiography, helmet, like a Prussian helmet on.
Oh, yes.
And it is not the same person, in my opinion. And so what I did was I discovered Francis Tumblety's nephew was General Charles Fitzsimmons, and found a photograph of him. And compared that photograph to the photograph that you found of Tumblety, there's a program where it scans the photograph, will give you a percentage of chances, and if it said above, it would be chances that's a relative. Wouldn't you know it gave 100%?
My God, that's absolutely incredible, isn't it?
So that's
I knew the photograph came from one of the private collections, and on the back, and it was one of the photographs that was originally sent to Hall Caine, and it's even signed on the back affectionately. When Tumblety always signed off to him, it was affectionately yours.
Yeah,
and it was FTMD.
Hmm.
And it's the same handwriting. It's absolutely right. And so I knew that I could be confident in this reveal to the world that right. It is Francis Tumblety. The person that owned the letters and photograph had no idea. They did not put that in my hand and say, this is a portrait of Francis Tumblety. At all. They said, here is the collection, here it is, it's been built up over a number of years, and there are some photographs, which included some actors and actresses, and there it was. You can imagine, I almost fell through the floor when I found it. But you see, the New York Historical Society had this copy of the Tumblety book, and that's the picture we all had to go on.
Yeah.
And I think for a while there were people that didn't like Tumblety on the grounds that they had visions of this man wearing jangling spurs, a cape with a fur collar and a spiked helmet striding through the streets of Whitechapel as Jack the Ripper. And I thought, no, for goodness sake, no. And I thought there was certainly a similarity to the man there. But what swung it for me was certainly the handwriting, the provenance, the look of the man. And when I compared it, there's an earlier Tumblety booklet, which has him as, he's got quite bulbous eyes and what looks like a very ludicrous moustache on there. And if you compare those two, there is quite a likeness to it. So I thought, well, there's got to be something in this. And in fact, I was convinced. Why would anybody else sign and send a photograph? Because Hall Caine would recognise it's not. It's not Tumblety immediately. I mean, as far as I can tell from the letters, the two have been intimate together in some form of homosexual relationship. We can't be clear about how intimate it was, but they're certainly spending the night together.
Right. Well, what's interesting also, but it helped the researcher to find out, well, that fits Tumblety to a T, that he would have a young man and his, as like a model for him, because that was 1871, which means he was 41 years old, and that photograph is a young 30-year-old young man. And there was, at the time, he had a young man named Mark A. Blackburn who would wear his clothes afterwards. And so you know Mark A. Blackburn was his same height, probably. Yeah. And he was probably a handsome young man because Tumbley had an affection for those.
And so
what, to me, I believe that's Mark A. Blackburn. And so right now I have feelers out to find a photograph of him, and that would be exciting to verify that.
That sounds very highly feasible. But in the same vein, I wouldn't be too surprised, you know, that he may have even... I wouldn't say employed, because he's very mean at times, but right. it could just as well be any young man that kind of struck him, that he rather liked the look on. Oh yes, you look like a younger version of me. Would you mind posing for this photograph? I'd like, you know, I want to show a younger me. And you can understand his persuasive ways. Tumblety was enormously persuasive. He really must have been quite a... I dislike the bloke intensely in some ways, but he must have had quite a charisma.
Yeah.
What do people have to look forward now with newer stories or things that are discovered? Like, that's interesting.
I think I would like to look at the victims of Jack the Ripper in general, because... Dear old Martin Fido coined a phrase, the canonical five, and it certainly works very well. There's a lot of logic to say, yes, it's rather like a canon of work, as sinister as that work may have been, but the canon of five victims ascribed to the killer Jack the Ripper. I will emphasize that this is not my discovery. I think it's a discovery that's really been brewing over a number of years and is a quite a cumulative thing between profilers, people that have worked in clinical psychology, researchers, both academic and amateur, because let's face it, there's some pretty good amateur sleuthing going on out there too, but it's a widely shared thought now that there were six viable victims of the killer known as Jack the Ripper. And this comes from an understanding of profiling and how serial killers work. This has been looked at on both sides of the Atlantic by people like John Douglas, Robert Ressler, back in the day, that had looked at the profile of Jack the Ripper. And I understand the FBI still use that as a bit of a case study that's quite useful for teaching those learning the techniques of investigation. And the idea is that the sixth victim was before any of the canonical five, before Polly Nichols. Now, Polly Nichols, she's the victim on Bucks Row. She's in late August. In early August, in the early hours, the 7th of August, 1888, the body of Martha Tabram was found on the first floor landing of a tenement known as George Yard Buildings. And she was what they would call in London an unfortunate. And I think we do need to be clear that some women were full-time prostitutes, but in the East End of London, the reason why so many women were absolutely terrified that they could become victims of Jack the Ripper is that they lived life hand-to-mouth. And that they might be doing okay one moment, doing a piecemeal job, or in a relationship, and the next thing you know, the old man's gone, or he's died, and you've lost your job, and you're destitute, and you'll end up selling your body on the street. It could be you. So we have to remember that, and I think that's important. And Martha Trabram was found on this landing on George Yard building, and she had been stabbed 39 times. So now, I challenge anybody to grab a, just take a pen in mid-air, or just make a fist, and just stab into thin air 39 times. And you think of the anger that must have been in that killer.
So, Neil, I'm going to do some research right now with you since you're here, because I have a question for you. That Martha Trabram, she was August 7th, and what's interesting is Mansfield's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde was being played at the Lyceum Theater, and it was, and the first show was, I think, on the 5th of November, and then the 6th of November, it was in the papers, and in the papers, even some reporters were making comments that transforming into a Mr. Hyde type at night, hopefully that doesn't incite some kind of activity. And what do you know? Here's Martha Trabram the next day. So in that Lyceum Theater, the business manager was Bram Stoker.
Yes, the Lyceum Company at that particular time were on tour. So that's how Mansfield came to have the stay. But what Bram was doing, he was working in Scotland at the time and on the tour. So he was able to see the case from both sides. So he would be reading the newspapers on the, because it's a long journey by train, so he could get up to speed with the case. But also, you know, when he's having to touch base at the Lyceum and going to see his family, who lived in London at the time as well. He's got a very good perspective on the crimes and what's happening and the take both on the street. You see, the thing was that people would, after a night at the theatre, you finish around midnight or a little after, London came alive at night. You know, you'd get onto a penny coach or catch a hansom cab, but a lot of the gentlefolk, they like to ride on one of these sort of penny coach, and it's a short ride from Theatreland, where you had the Lyceum and other theatres, and they'd go and have a look round the East End, and they would watch these folks gathered round hot braziers, the hot potato sellers and the gin shops, and the pubs, and there'd be fights on the street.
Was this slumming? Slumming
would be if you would tend to try and stay there. If you got out of the coach, a bit like what Jack London did, that was true slumming, moving amongst the belly of the beast, looking like one of the locals. But they were the toffs. The nickname of the posh devils, it would be taking a walk on the wild side. Sometimes they would refer to it as slumming. If you got out of the coach, that was a very different and quite dangerous experience, because if you've got to imagine that the streets, the main street, Whitechapel High Street, big broad street, that's okay. In fact, you had people with quite a lot of wealth, because you had the London Hospital down there. They were living on that frontage, and there'd be stalls and all sorts down there. But if you went off that street, you'd be in some of the most deprived streets up the alleyways. Like if you went up George Yard, up by the White Hart, off Whitechapel High Street, that's abject poverty there. You see, it was a dodgy thing, and if you went up one of these alleyways, you know, with a woman of the night, an unfortunate, you paid your money, well, it could well be that she'd have an accomplice up there in the dark, and they'd do what they call shag bagging, and which is when they have a sock filled with clay, and they'll either whack you across the head when you are incapacitated, because the unfortunate woman would bend forward, flip her skirts up. She wouldn't lay on the ground. And you would not, once your breeches are dropped and you start, you're in a quite a vulnerable situation, that's when the accomplice would shagbag you. Good old thump to the throat. You'd be knocked out. Your pocket watch, money would be nicked. And then the next thing you know, you'd have a matcher come along, or a felcher. And that means felching around looking for any money that's left. Or they'd take your clothes. And the last and the worst of them, you know, these sort of felchers, they would come along, they'd even take your boots, you'd be next to naked. And you'd be lucky to get away with your life.
Right.
So that was a real walk on the wild side, but people would do that. They would sometimes go and fight with the locals as well. You'll see engravings of gentlefolk, gentlemen in their top hats and best dress for the theatre on their way back with a few of their gentlemen friends. They'd go and have a little bit of a thump up with some of the East End roughs to see if they can hold their own against them. It was a very different world at that time. But anyway, the point of Mansfield, his performance, if you think of the way audiences reacted to Psycho in America, this is how his performance affected people in London. The terror became infectious. People would go anticipating being frightened. And my God, he delivered it. And so there was a lingering thought from the early 19th century, the whole notion of man and machine, this idea of Frankenstein, that man could create man who is dead from all these body parts, use electricity to bring him back to life. This was man sort of taking over God's work. And that was dodgy stuff. That challenged it.
It was a scientific question back then. Can we extend life? That was a natural question back then.
It certainly was. And then once you get to a greater understanding of medicine in the 19th century, as the century progressed, then the notion that Robert Louis Stevenson had, that wrote the original Dr. Jekyll, as in treacle, it was Mansfield who liked the idea of Jekyll being pronounced Jekyll because it sounded more sinister. They thought, well, what about this potion that a man could drink and become a monster? It was also allegorical. It was allegorical that those who took to the demon drink, or worse still, drugs, because, you know, there's some pretty hard drugs available on the streets. Dope, opiums, they are known. They're dope dens all over, Limehouses, you know, they're in all over the place in London. And you'll see that depicted in the film From Hell, starring Johnny Depp, which is also about the Jack the Ripper crimes. You'll see the opium dens there. So the idea was, can man take drink, opium, drugs? A decent man, a good man, can he take these things and turn into a monster?
Another question is, Henry Irving, you were talking about, he was not there at the time as well, correct? Was he with Bram Stoker with Henry?
Henry Irving's on tour with the Lyceum Company. So when you're looking at the sort of August-September period, they're up to November, they're out and around the country. That's why the Lyceum stage is free, and Irving's performing around about the place.
Okay, so then my thought was, we know that in the 1870s, Francis Tumbley was attempting to dominate Sir Henry Hall Caine, or Henry Hall Caine at the time, he was a young man, but I don't see Tumbley at all being able to dominate someone like Henry Irving. Even though Tumbley loved the theater, loved the actors, I could almost see Henry Irving not appreciating Tumbley. And so I'm thinking that Henry Irving is gone at the time. And Mansfield's Jekyll and Hyde was being played prior to that in New York City and Boston and where Tumbley was before that. So I'd be curious to see the interaction of what Tumbley was with Henry Irving.
Irving's a very interesting character. That Irving trusted Bram Stoker implicitly with really the business side of the theatre. Of course, Irving would have acquaintances and people that he wished to invite into his exclusive circle that would sit after performances. You see, they had what they called the Beefsteak Club Room, Yeah. Now, this is not to be confused with the Old Beefsteak Club, which is a gentleman's club in London. They used to meet in this room in the Lyceum. When Irving took over the theatre, they no longer met there. But it was on another occasion when Irving was working away and Stoker was looking after the theatre that Bram Stoker thought, we've got a room there. It's a junk room. It's full of all sorts of boxes and stuff. And really, rather than sitting in the wings or on the end of the stage when everyone's gone home and eating a sandwich and trying to get a brief bite to eat in the Lyceum after their performance, why don't we actually have a decent place to eat, a meal? And so he had the room cleared, put a lovely refectory table in it and decorated it with Irving memorabilia. In a lot of ways, it was a shrine to, it became, certainly became a shrine to Henry Irving. And it was there that they would have a proper menu, and the guests that Bram Stoker thought would be worth having for the benefit of the theatre, also for the benefit of the group, who are interesting, who's influential, who, you know, the actors and actresses that would like to join in too. So it wasn't just a male exclusive environment. And it would not surprise me at all that, you see, Bram Stoker was absolutely fascinated with Abraham Lincoln. And I actually found a poster for talks at Toynbee Hall. Now, Toynbee Hall's in the East End of London. That's actually in the heart of Ripper territory. And Bram Stoker gave a talk there on Abraham Lincoln. And as an aside, on the American tour of the Lyceum, Bram Stoker got to meet another one of his heroes, Walt Whitman, the author of Leaves of Grass. And Whitman was also a great collector of Lincoln memorabilia and the story of Lincoln. And when he passed away, he left that to Bram Stoker, his collection, his writings on Lincoln. So Bram certainly had a great interest in Lincoln, so much so it was Bram that encouraged Edwin Booth. Now, Edwin Booth is the brother of John Wilkes Booth, who assassinated Lincoln.
Right.
So Bram's going to want to know him, so why not get to know him professionally? Because he was also a good actor, you know.
Yes.
Let's not taint him with John Wilkes Booth. You know, his brother was a damn fine actor. And so there were nights when Booth would play Iago and Irving would play Othello. And then they would swap over the following week, or sometimes they'd do it as a surprise the following night. They were that good. So you can imagine, right, we've got the assassin of Lincoln's brother sat, you know, could sit at the Beefsteak Club table. It's a chance to talk. It's a chance to hear the stories from the brother of the man who shot Lincoln. And I think because of the way Tumblety liked to embroil himself into the Lincoln conspiracy, being involved in the McLennan staff stories, you know, the yellow fever stuff, he could weave a tale. He had the charisma. And I think purely because they would be Bram would be intrigued by this man that held such a grim hold over Hall Caine. And maybe even Hall Caine would be bolstered by, because Bram was a big, strong man.
Yeah.
So I think we've got to have this man round the table. I want to see for myself. Who knows? Maybe somewhere.
So, Neil, Al, you don't mind, we're going to talk for another 2 hours. And or are we over our time?
No, we're just about out of time now. So,
bummer.
Now, yeah, no, that's all right. Neil, do you have a website or a place that you'd like people to go if they want to follow up with you?
If they want to follow up, look out for my book. Mike has spoken so very kindly and highly of it. It is The Dracula Secrets, Jack the Ripper and the Darkest Sources of Bram Stoker. It's published by History Press, and it's available. You can get it on, you know, online from Amazon, or can be ordered from good bookshops when we could go out and about. But get online, get a copy, and they'd be more than welcome. If they're really interested, you know, you can always find me via my publishers or find me on Facebook. Join the community and see our adventures in history.
Well, one benefit of my copy is mine's signed.
It is. And again, I'd like to just say to all our friends and to all of the listeners, please just take care of yourselves, be kind to each other, keep safe and well, and I hope to share some stories of this remarkable period in time and some of the darkest tales in history with Al and Mike. And thank you both for having me on the show.
Thanks, Neil.
Fantastic. Thank you.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, where are you, the police?
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.